wound in file through the fields on either side of it, and a string of wounded dragged themselves along to the rear. A young artilleryman had a long, jagged splutter sticking out from his shoulder. We turned off the road to the right to regimental headquarters, which were in a ring of shellfire. Two signalers were laying telephone wire in a field of cabbages nearby. A shell went up close beside one of them. We saw him fall, and took it he was finished. However, he picked himself up, and with admirable sang-froid, continued unrolling his wire. As headquarters were no more than a tiny concrete blockhouse, where there was scarcely room for the commanding officer and his staff, I had to seek quarters elsewhere. With the intelligence, gas, and trench-mortar officers, I shared a flimsy wooden hut that was scarcely the ideal of a bomb-proof shelter. In the afternoon I went up the line as a report had come in that the enemy had that morning made an attack on our 5th Company. My way took me over the Meldekopf to Nordhof, a farm shelled out of all recognition, beneath whose ruins dwelt the commanding officer of the battalion in reserve. Thence, a track that was still just to be discerned led to the CO of the troops in the line. The vast field of shell holes had been turned into a sea of mud by the heavy rain of the last days. Its depths were particularly dangerous in the low-lying ground of the Paardebeek. On my zigzag course I passed many a lonely and forgotten corpse. Often only a head or a hand projected from the shell-hole, whose circle of dirty water reflected them. Thousands sleep like that, without one token of love to mark the unknown grave. I crossed the Paardebeek after the utmost exertions, and only with the help of some poplars that a shell had flung across it, and found the officer in command of the 5th Company, Lieutenant Heinz, in a giant shell-hole with what remained of his company around him. Their shell-hole line lay on a slope, and since it was not entirely flooded, might be called habitable by the unassuming front-line soldier. Heinz told me that the English had come on in line that morning, but had disappeared when fire was opened on them. The enemy had, however, shot a few men of the 164th Regiment, who had lost their way, and ran for it at their approach. Apart from this, all was in order, and I returned forthwith to headquarters and made my report to the commanding officer. On the following day we were most rudely interrupted at lunch by a few shells planted right in front of the door. Descending fountains of soil beat long tattoos on our tarred roof. There was a rush for the door. I fled to a farm close at hand, and as it was raining I went inside. In the evening the same performance was repeated, only this time, as it was fine, I stood outside the farmhouse. The next shell fell right in the middle of it. Such are the chances of war. Here, more than anywhere, it is a case of little causes and great effects. Seconds and millimeters make the difference. On the 28th, we were driven from the huts by 8 o'clock, and one of those opposite us got a direct hit on the second shot. Others fell in the waterlogged meadows. They made less noise, but they scooped out some fine holes. Prompted by the experiences of the day before, I sought out a lonely shell-hole of dimensions to inspire confidence in the cabbage field behind headquarters, and I would never leave it again until a considerable safety margin had elapsed. I heard that day the news, particularly distressing to me, of the death of Lieutenant Brecht. He had met his heroic death in the shell-hole area to the right of the Nordhof, while acting as a divisional observation officer. He was one of those few who were encircled by a nimbus of romance, even in the most material of wars, owing to their insatiable daredevilry. Many like him always stood out from the common run. They laughed every time an attack was ordered. The morning of the 26th was occupied by drum fire of unusual intensity. Our artillery, too, doubled its fury when the signals for a barrage went up in the front line. Every little bit of wood and every hedge was crammed with guns, and behind them the half-dazed gunners were kept hard at work. As the reports of the wounded about an English attack were confused and exaggerated, I was sent forward at 11 with my four men to obtain more exact information. We had to pass through a sharp fire and met a great number of wounded, among them Lieutenant Spitz, commanding the 12th Company, wounded in the chin. Even before reaching the headquarters of the battalion in the line, we were in a direct machine-gun fire, a sign that the enemy must have broken through. This fear was soon confirmed by Major Dietlein, commanding officer of the 3rd Battalion. I found the old gentleman in the act of creeping out of the entrance of his blockhouse, which was three parts underwater, and fishing zealously for his meerschaum cigar holder, which had fallen into the mud. The enemy had broken through the front line and taken a ridge from which he commanded the important area of the Paderbeek and battalion headquarters situated there. After I had marked the alteration of the front in blue chalk on my map, I set out on a fresh steeplechase through the mud with my men. We ran at full speed over the exposed ground till a slope gave us cover, and then we proceeded more slowly to Nordhof. Shells were falling to right and left in the boggy ground, and throwing up large mountains of mud surrounded by countless smaller ones. Nordhof was being shelled with HE in a nerve-shattering manner, and we had to reach it in jumps. The noise these things made was really most hideous and quite deafening. They came over in groups at short intervals. The only thing to do was to cover the ground in short darts, and then wait for the next shots in a shell hole. The interval between the first distant howl and the explosion nearby is marked by a peculiarly painful emphasis upon the instinct of self-preservation, since the body is reduced to a state of defenseless and motionless waiting. But I am afraid my insistence on the fact that the war was no child's play will become burdensome. The picture of every day was at last made up of such experiences. There was shrapnel, too, among the rest. One of them scattered its bullets with a clatter among us, and one of my men was hit on the hind rim of his helmet and thrown to the ground. After he had lain, stunned, for some while, he picked himself up and ran on. The ground round Nordhof was strewn with terribly mutilated bodies. As we carried out our job in a sporting spirit, we were often in places that had just ceased to be possible. In this way, the unseen events of the battlefield came to our eyes. We were everywhere pressed on the heels of death. It was almost as though not one living soul was to be found in this desolation. Here lay a group behind a tattered hedge, their bodies covered by the still fresh earth that showered on them after the shell had burst. There, two runners near a shell hole from which the suffocating vapor of the explosives still exhaled. At other spots there were many corpses scattered over a small surface, a carrying party caught in a vortex of shell bursts, or a strayed platoon coming up in support had found an end there. We appeared, took in the drama at one glance, and disappeared into the smoke again. When we had safely crossed the much-shelled bit of ground behind the Parschendieler Westrusebecker Road, I was able to give intelligence to the commander of the regiment. Next morning I was dispatched to the front line at 6 o'clock to ascertain whether and where the regiment was in touch with the units on its flanks. On the way I met Sergeant Major Feschlund, who had to take orders to the 8th Company to advance on Gutberg and fill the gap, if there should be one, between us and the regiment on the left. The quickest way to carry out my task was to go along with him. After a long search we found my friend Tebbe, commanding the 8th Company, in an inhospitable part of the shelled area near the Meldekopf. He was not particularly pleased at the notion of executing the proposed movement in broad daylight. We lit cigars while waiting for the company to assemble and conducted a laconic conversation in the dreary and oppressive surroundings that the morning light revealed. Before we had gone a few steps, we were under rifle fire from high ground in front, and we had to go forward by jumps from one shell hole to the other, each man on his own. As we went across the next rise, the fire was so concentrated that Tebbe gave the order to take up a position in shell holes until night came on. Smoking his cigar, he went with great coolness along the whole length of his front. I decided to go on and ascertain the width of the gap, and first I rested a while in Tebbe's shell hole. Soon the enemy artillery began to resent the company's imprudent advance and got the range of the strip of ground we were on. A bit of shell that struck our refuge, throwing the soil over my map and into my eyes, gave me the tip to go. I bade farewell to Tebbe and wished him good luck for the hours ahead. He called after me, "God send the night. The morning will come of itself." We made our way cautiously through the low-lying ground of the Paardebeek, which was overlooked by the enemy, taking cover behind the branches shot away from the poplars, and using their trunks as a bridge. Now and then one of us sank in mud above the hips and would certainly have drowned before the rifle butts that the others stretched out to help him up. I chose as our objective a group of men standing round a concrete blockhouse. In front of us, moving in the same direction, there were four stretcher-bearers carrying a stretcher. It made me suspicious to see a wounded man being carried forward, so I took my glasses and then saw a line of khaki-colored figures with flat helmets. At the same moments, the first shots snapped out. As there was no cover to take, we ran, and the bullets spurted the mud up on all sides of us. The chase through the morass was frantically exhausting, and when completely pumped, we had to stop for a while and give the English a good target. But a few HEs soon restored us to our first vigor. All the same, they had the advantage of concealing us from the enemy in their smoke. The worst feature of this run was knowing that a wound would drown one for certainty in a mud hole. A suffusion of blood on the surface of a shell hole here and there showed that many a man had vanished thus. I was dead tired when we reached headquarters. I gave in my sketch and made a report on the situation. On the 28th of October, we were relieved again by the 10th Bavarian Reserve Regiment, and quartered among the villages behind the line, to be put in again at any moment. The staff moved to Must. In the evening, we were sitting in a deserted inn. We were already in the best of spirits again, and celebrating the promotion of Lieutenant Zürn, who had been mentioned in dispatches and had just come back from leave. As a punishment for our light-heartedness, we were awakened next morning by gigantic drum fire that blew in my window panes in spite of our distance from it, immediately after the alarm was given. There was a rumor that the enemy had broken through by the gap that still persisted on the regiment's left flank. I spent the day waiting for orders at the artillery observation post, the neighborhood of which was being sporadically shelled. A light shell went through the window of a small house and drove out three gunners, wounded and covered with brick dust. The corpses of three others remained beneath the wreckage. The morning after, I had the following orders from the commanding officer of the Bavarians. Owing to repeated attacks by the enemy, the front of the regiment on the left flank has been still further pushed back, and the gap between the regiments greatly widened. As there was danger of our flank being turned from the left, the 1st Battalion of the 73rd Fusiliers counter-attacked yesterday. Apparently, however, it was dispersed by the barrage and never reached the enemy. This morning the 2nd Battalion was sent forward to close the gap. So far, no news has been received. Information is now required as to the position of the 1st and 2nd Battalions. I set out, and had only got as far as Nordhof when I met Captain von Brixen, commanding officer of the 2nd Battalion, who had a sketch map of the disposition of the troops ready to hand in his pocket. I took a copy of it, and with this my task was really completed. However, I went on all the same to the headquarters of the troops in the line, which I found in a concrete blockhouse, in order to make a personal reconnaissance. On the way I passed great numbers of recent casualties. The white faces stared out of the brimming shell holes, or were already so mud-bespattered that the human face was scarcely recognizable. I was sorry to see the blue Gibraltar badge on most of them. The commanding officer was a Bavarian, Captain Radlmeier, a very energetic officer. He gave me full details of the position that Captain von Brixen had hastily told me of. Our 2nd Battalion had suffered heavy losses, among them the adjutant and the officer commanding the valiant 7th Company. The fate of the adjutant, Lieutenant Lemierre, was particularly tragic, as his brother had been killed the April before at Prenoy, in command of the 8th Company. Both brothers belonged to the Principality of Liechtenstein, but they had joined the army out of enthusiasm for the cause of Germany. It is fatal for 2 sons to be in 1 regiment in wartime. We had 4 pairs of brothers among the officers of the regiment. Of these 8, 5 were killed, and 2, one of whom was my brother, were severely wounded. I was the only one to come through in a fairly sound state. This little example shows the losses of the Fusiliers. The captain pointed to a concrete post about 200 meters in front of our line, which had been defended with particular heroism the day before. Shortly after the attack began, the commander of this little strong point, a sergeant major, saw an Englishman who was taking off 3 German prisoners. He shot the Englishman and added the 3 to the strength of his garrison, though it did not appear that he found in them an exactly heroic trio. When they had shot away their ammunition, they tied an Englishman in front of the entrance as a peaceful signboard, and at dark succeeded, after all, in escaping unobserved. Another strong point, commanded by a lieutenant, was summoned to surrender. Instead of making an answer, the German leaped out, and seizing the English officer, dragged him inside before the eyes of his bewildered men. That day, for the only time in the war, I saw small bodies of stretcher-bearers moving about in the open with the Red Cross flag without a shot being fired. Such a sight was unknown to the front-line soldier in this subterranean war, except when matters were very desperate. Nevertheless, I heard later on that some of our stretcher-bearers had been shot by English snipers. This fact may seem astounding, and yet I can explain it to myself. Weak natures are prone to the atavistic impulse to destroy, and it takes hold of the trench fighter in his desolate existence when anyone appears above ground. I have felt it myself only too often. I had an unpleasant time on my way back owing to the irritant gas of the English shells. The ground was saturated with it. It smelt of rotten apples and made the eyes run. After making my report to headquarters, I met 2 stretchers just outside the dressing station at Calve. On each, severely wounded, was an officer whom I knew well. One was Lieutenant Zürn, in whose honor we had made a night of it only 2 evenings before. Now he lay half undressed on a door. His face had that hint of yellow which is the certain precursor of death, and he looked at me with fixed eyes when I went up to take his hand. The other, Lieutenant Haverkamp, had the bones of a leg and an arm so shattered by a shell that an amputation was extremely probable. He was as white as death, and he lay on his stretcher with his features heroically set, smoking a cigarette. Our losses in young officers were, again, frightfully heavy during these days. Every time afterwards that I heard prejudice and depreciation on the lips of the mob, I thought of these men who saw it out to the bitter end with so little parade and with so fine an ardor. But after all, what is the mob? It sees in everything nothing but the reflection of its own manners. It is quite clear to me that these men were our best. However cleverly people may talk and write, there is nothing to set against self-sacrifice that is not pale, insipid, and miserable. On the 3rd of November we entrained at Gitz, whose situation was familiar to us from our earliest Flanders days. We found that the 2 Flemish girls had lost their old freshness. They, too, seemed to have lived through days of battle in the meantime. Next we were for some days in rest at Tourcoing, an imposing sister city of Lille. For the first time, and the last during the war, every man of the 7th Company slept on a featherbed. I occupied a magnificently furnished room in the house of an industrial magnate in the Rue de Lille. The first evening, with an open fire, the indispensable marble mantelpiece, and an armchair, was unspeakably delightful. The few days were passed by everybody in enjoying life that had been so hardly won. It was still scarcely believable that death had been escaped, and it seemed a necessity to assure oneself of it by enjoying life in every aspect. The Battle of Cambrai. The delightful days at Tourcoing were soon over. For a short while longer, we were at Villers-au-Tertre, where we were made up to strength by new drafts, and then we went by train on the 15th of November to L'Écluse, the resting place of the battalion in reserve on the new front now assigned to us. L'Écluse was a fairly large village of Artois, surrounded by lakes. The immense reedy marshes concealed ducks and waterfowl, and the water was alive with fish. Though fishing was strictly forbidden, mysterious sounds were often heard on the water at night. One day, too, I had presented to me by the town major a few paybooks of men in my company who had been caught fishing with bombs. I wasted no words over that, however, for the good spirits of the men were very much more to me than the protection of French fishing waters or the dinner tables of the resident military magnates. After this, a gigantic pike was laid on my table nearly every evening by an unknown hand, and on the next day I gave my two company officers a meal, at which the principal dish was pike à la Lohengrin. Ask me no more. On the 19th, I inspected our position in the line with my platoon commanders, as we were going in a day or two. It was in front of the village of Vison-Artois. We were not so soon in the line as we expected, as there was an alarm nearly every night, and on account of an English attack that was supposed to be coming off, we were held in readiness by turns in the Votan line, the reserve gun positions, or in Dury village. Those who had war experience could see that something unpleasant would come of it. On the 29th of November we were, in fact, told by our commanding officer, Captain von Brixen, that we were to take part in a highly organized counter-attack to straighten the bulge that the Cambrai tank battle had made in our front. We were delighted, certainly, to change the part of the anvil for that of the hammer at last. But we had some reservations on account of the men, after their recent exhaustion in Flanders. Nevertheless, I had entire confidence in the spirit of my company and its iron backbone, in my experienced platoon commanders and excellent NCOs. On the night of November the 30th through December the 1st, we were put on lorries. It was in the course of this that my company had its first casualties. One of the men let a bomb fall, and for some mysterious reason it went off and severely wounded him and one other. Another man, in the hope of getting sent back, pretended to be mad. I did not know whether to laugh or to storm at him. Finally he recovered his reason at the suggestion of an NCO who gave him a powerful dig in the ribs. And we were all able to get in. We were conveyed, tightly packed together, almost as far as Barral, and there we waited hour after hour for orders in the ditch by the roadside. In spite of the cold, I lay down in a grass field and slept till dawn. We were somewhat disappointed when we were told that the 225th Regiment was going over the top without our assistance. Pending developments, we were to stand by in the park of the Chateau of Barral. At 9 o'clock our artillery broke into heavy bursts of fire and increased between 11:45 and 11:50 to drum fire. Boulogne Wood, which, owing to the strength of its defences, had been left out of the frontal attack, disappeared under yellowish-green clouds of gas. At 11:50 we saw the attacking waves through glasses, as they emerged upon the vacant expanse of shell holes. While further back, batteries harnessed up and raced forward to new positions. A German scout shot down an English captive balloon in flames, and the observer jumped out with a parachute. After enjoying this panorama of battle from the high ground of the park, we emptied a dixie of dumplings, and in spite of the cold, laid ourselves down on the ground for an afternoon sleep. At 3, orders came through to go forward as far as regimental headquarters, which were concealed in the lock of a drained canal. We covered this distance in detachments under moderate and scattered shell fire. From there, the 7th and 8th companies were sent forward to report to the officer commanding the troops in reserve, so as to relieve 2 companies of the 225th. The 500 meters we had to go along the bed of the canal were covered by a band of fire. We ran in one mob and reached our goal without a casualty. There were numerous dead here to show that many a company had paid heavy toll. Reserves were crowded along the sides of the canal and were feverishly digging out holes in the retaining walls to serve as cover. As the whole space was occupied, and as the canal was a landmark that drew the enemy's fire, I led the company off to the right among the shell holes and gave orders for each man to see to himself. A splinter rang against my bayonet. Lieutenant Tebbe had followed my example with the 8th Company, and now we looked out a suitable shell hole and covered it with a ground sheet. We then lit a candle, ate our supper, lit our pipes, and talked and shivered. At 11 o'clock I got orders to proceed to the former front line and to report to the CO of the battalion in the line, under whose orders the 7th Company was. I gave the order to fall in and led the company forward. There were only isolated shells, but very heavy ones. One of them that crashed in front of us was like a glimpse of hell, and filled the whole canal bed with black vapor. The men were dumbfounded as though by a blow of an iron fist on the nape of the neck, and stumbled hurriedly on behind me over barbed wire and stone rubble. A feeling of indescribable discomfort steals upon the nerves, even though the shell fire is not particularly heavy when one is traversing an unfamiliar part of the line by night. The strangest illusions play upon the eye and ear, and the menacing walls of the trench inspire a sense of loneliness, like that of a child that has lost its way on a dark heath. At last we found the narrow mouth of the first line in the wall of the canal, and went on through overcrowded trenches to battalion headquarters. I went in and found a mob of officers and orderlies in an atmosphere that could be cut with a knife. I was told that the attack on the front had not achieved much, and that it was to be renewed the next morning. The feeling in the air was not very hopeful. 2 commanding officers began a long discussion with their adjutants. Now and then, from the height of their bunks, that were as crowded as hen roosts, the specialist officers threw a few crumbs into the debate. The cigar fumes were suffocating. Batmen endeavoured to cut bread for their officers in the throng. A wounded officer who burst in aroused a passing alarm with the news of an enemy bombing attack. Finally, I was able to take down my orders for the attack. At 6 a.m. I and my company were to roll up Dragon Alley and as much of the Siegfried line as possible. The 2 battalions of the regiment in the line were to attack on our right at 7. This difference of time aroused my immediate and resolute dislike. I raised a number of objections to splitting up the attack in this way, and gained my point. We too were to attack at 7. We found out the importance of this alteration the next morning. Fighting experience in an officer commanding troops can often, in cases like this, spare much unnecessary bloodshed. A company detached from its own unit is not likely to be pampered under alien command. As I had only the haziest notion of the whereabouts of Dragon Alley, I asked as I was going for a map. Unfortunately, not a single one could be spared. I made a silent comment and went out. After I and the men with their heavy packs had wandered up and down the trenches for a long while, one of the men discovered a board with the scarcely legible inscription, Dragon Alley. It was at the entrance of a narrow trench branching off to the front and blocked with knife rests. After entering it, and before I had gone many paces, I heard voices in a foreign tongue. I was very much astonished to find the enemy so close, and indeed almost in our own lines, without having come upon any measures of defense, and I at once posted a section to block the trench. Close to Dragon Alley there was an enormous pit, apparently a tank trap. There I collected the whole company and explained the plan of attack and assigned their respective parts to each platoon. My remarks were interrupted several times by light shells. Once even a dud hurtled against the rear wall of our pit. Standing on the edge above, I saw a deep and regular inclination of the moonlit helmets at every hit. I took the precaution of sending the first and second platoons back into the trench in case of an unlucky direct hit, and remained with the third in the pit. Some men of a party which had come to grief in Dragon Alley the day before put the wind up my men by telling them that 50 meters along there was an English machine gun that made further advance impossible. In view of this tale, I made it understood with the platoon commanders that at the first resistance we should jump out on both sides of the trench and make a concerted bombing attack. It is more than ever important to keep up a regiment's fighting prestige when attached to another unit. I spent the endless hours squeezed up against Lieutenant Hupf in a small hole. I got up at 6 and made the final arrangements in a mood peculiar to the last hour before an attack. There's a lonely, sinking feeling in the stomach as one speaks to the section leaders, tries to make jokes, and keeps running to and fro as if before an inspection by the divisional commander. In short, one tries to be as occupied as possible in order to escape the thoughts that drill into the brain. One of the men offered me a cup of coffee heated in a trench cooker. Its warmth cheered me to the marrow. At 7 sharp we advanced in single file in the prearranged order. We found Dragon Alley unoccupied. A number of empty drums behind a block showed that the machine gun must have been withdrawn. Our fighting spirit kindled at this. We went along a narrow, sunken way after passing on our right a well-built trench, where I left a few men posted. The sunken road became shallower and shallower, till at last we found ourselves in the open, just as dawn broke. We then turned back and entered the trench on the right. It was full of arms and equipment and English dead. It was the Siegfried line, and suddenly Lieutenant Hoppenrot, the leader of the storming section, snatched a rifle from one of the men and fired. He had come on an English post, which after a few bombs had been thrown, took to flight. We went on, and a moment later a fresh stand was encountered. Bombs flew on both sides and burst with resounding din. Now the technique of the storm troop came into play. A chain of bombs went from hand to hand along the trench. Snipers took up positions behind traverses, ready to draw a bead on the enemy bombers. The platoon commanders kept an eye out over the top to see a counterattack in the nick of time, and the light machine gun section mounted their guns where there was a good field of fire. After a short fight, we heard agitated voices from the other side, and before we understood what was happening, the first Englishmen came towards us with their hands up. One after another turned the corner of the traverse and unbuckled his belt, while our rifles and revolvers were threateningly leveled. They were all young, well-set-up fellows in new uniforms. I let them pass with the command, hands down, and detailed a squad to take them to the rear. Most of them showed by their confiding smiles that they trusted in us as human beings. Others held out cigarettes and chocolates in order to conciliate us. My enthusiasm and delight when I saw what a bag we had made were unbounded. The procession had no end. We had counted 150 already, and still they came with their hands above their heads. I went up to an officer and asked him how far their position extended, and how many men they had. He answered very politely, but impaired the good impression he made by being so very stiff about it. He then conducted me to the commander of the company, a captain, who was lying wounded in a deep dugout nearby. He was about 28 years old, with a clear-cut face. I found him leaning against the timbers at the foot of the shaft, with a wound through the calf. I introduced myself, and he raised his hand to his cap, showing, as he did so, a gold chain. He told me his name and gave up his revolver. His first words showed that I had a man to deal with. We were surrounded. He could not rest till he had told his enemy why he had allowed his company to be taken prisoners so quickly. We had a talk on various matters in French. He told me there were a number of German wounded in a neighboring dugout, whom his men had bound up and looked after. When I asked him how strongly held the Siegfried line was further on, he declined to reply. I promised to get him and the other casualties sent back, and we parted with a shake of the hand. Outside, the men reported that we had taken 200 prisoners, a fine achievement for a company of 80 strong. I had guards mounted, and we then looked round the captured trench. It was bristling with arms and equipment. On the fire steps were machine guns, mortars, bombs and rifle grenades, water bottles, sheepskin waistcoats, Macintosh capes, ground sheets, cases of bully beef, jam, tea, coffee, cocoa, and tobacco, bottles of rum, tools, revolvers, very light pistols, clothing, gloves, in short, everything imaginable. Like an old soldier of fortune, I allowed an interval for plunder, nor could I resist the temptation myself of having a small breakfast prepared for me by my batman in a dugout entrance and lighting a pipe of the navy cut I had so long been without, while I scribbled a report to the commanding officer of the troops in the line. Like a wise man, I sent a duplicate to our own CO. After half an hour, we proceeded, in an exalted mood, to which the English rum may have contributed, and stalked from traverse to traverse along the Siegfried line. We were fired on from a pillbox built into the trench, and got on to the next fire step to study the lie of the land. While we were exchanging a shot or two with the inmates, a man was struck to the ground as though by an invisible hand. A shot had pierced the crown of his helmet and torn a long groove in his skull. His brain could be seen throbbing with each beat of his heart, and yet he was able to make his way back alone. I called for volunteers to carry the place by assault over the top. The men looked at each other in hesitation. Only an ungainly Pole, whom I had always thought weak in the head, clambered out of the trench and stumped off heavily to assault the pillbox alone. But now Fenrich Neupert sprang over the top with his section, while we at the same time advanced along the trench. The English fired a few shots and ran for it, abandoning the pillbox to us. One of the Fenrich's men was shot dead halfway over, and lay with his face to the earth a few steps from the goal. Going further, we met with a resolute resistance from some unseen bomb-throwers, and after considerable butchery we were driven back to the pillbox. There we made a block. We, as well as the English, left a number of dead in the disputed length of trench. Among them, unhappily, was the NCO Mavius, whom, in the night of Regnéville, I had learned to value as a daring fighter. He lay with his face in a pool of blood. When I turned him over, I saw a big hole in his forehead, and knew that nothing could help him. After the enemy also had retired a little, an obstinate shooting match began. In the course of it, a Lewis gun, posted 50 meters from us, forced us to duck our heads. A light machine gun on our side took the duel on. For half a minute, the two murderous weapons rattled on at each other, with the bullets spurting round them. Then our gunner, the volunteer Mutulo, was killed by a shot through the head. Though his brain fell over his face to his chin, His mind was still clear when we took him to the nearest dugout. By degrees, things calmed down as the English, too, were busy making a block. At 12, Captain von Brixen, Tebbe, and Voigt appeared and congratulated me on the company's success. We sat down in the pillbox and lunched off the English provisions and discussed the situation. Meanwhile, I held a conversation in shouts with about 25 English, whose heads emerged out at the trench about 100 meters in front of us, and who apparently wished to give themselves up. As soon as I showed myself, however, I was shot at from further behind them. Suddenly there was a commotion at the barricade. Bombs flew, rifles pinged, and machine guns rattled. "They're coming! They're coming!" We jumped to our sandbags and fired away. One of my men, the volunteer Kempenhaus, jumped onto the top of the block in the heat of the battle and fired into the trench till he fell severely wounded in both arms. I made a note of this hero of the hour and had the pleasure, 14 days later, of congratulating him on the Iron Cross of the First Class. We had scarcely gone back to lunch after this little interlude when a fresh heathenish alarm broke upon us. There followed one of those extraordinary episodes in which, great and small, the history of the war is so rich. A subaltern of the regiment on our left who had come to get into touch with us became inspired by a boundless pugnacity. It seemed that drink had inflamed his inborn courage to madness. "Where's the Tommy? At the dogs. Who's coming?" In his rage he pulled down our fine block and plunged on, clearing a road for himself with a roar of bombs. In front of him, through the trench, flitted his orderly and finished off with his rifle those whom the bombs had spared. When a man makes himself the stake with crazy daring, his example is always infectious. We were all wrought up, and snatching up bombs ran to take part in the improvised assault. I was soon up with the fellow, nor did the other officers, followed by most of the company, hang back. The CO himself, Captain von Brixen, was among the foremost. He had picked up a rifle, and he shot down several enemy bombers over our heads. The English resisted valiantly. Every traverse was contested. Mills bombs and stick bombs crossed and recrossed. Behind each we found dead or still quivering bodies. We killed each other out of sight. And there were losses on our side, too. A bomb fell close to the orderly and burst before he could get clear. He fell with a dozen wounds from which his blood trickled into the soil. We sprang on over his body. Thunderous reports gave us our direction. Hundreds of eyes lay in wait in the desolation behind rifles and machine guns. We were a long way in front of our own lines. Bullets whistled from all sides round our heads or landed with a hard smack on the edge of the trench. One had to have courage here, and every one had. Otherwise, he would not have ventured on it. Each time that one of the egg-shaped bombs appeared, the eye seized it with a precision only possible to a man whose life hangs on the issue. Then one threw a bomb oneself and jumped forward. Scarce a glance fell on the huddled body of the enemy. He was done for, and now a fresh duel began. A trench branching off to the right was cleared by some men of the 225th Regiment, who were following us. Caught between two fires, the English tried to escape across the open, and were shot down like game at a battue. Then came the climax. The enemy, hard-pressed, and with us always at his heels, made ready to retire by a communication trench that turned away to the right. I jumped onto a fire step and saw that this trench, for a good stretch, ran parallel to ours at a distance of only 20 meters. So the enemy had to pass by us once more. We could look right down on the helmets of the English, who stumbled over each other in their haste and excitement. I lobbed a bomb at the feet of the foremost. They started back and crowded on those behind. Now began an indescribable carnage. Bombs flew through the air like snowballs, till the whole scene was veiled in white smoke. Two men handed me bombs ready to throw without a moment's pause. Bombs splashed and exploded among the mob of English, throwing them aloft in fragments with their helmets. Cries of rage and terror were mingled. With the fire in our eyes, we sprang with a shout over the top. In the midst of this tumult, I was struck to the earth by a terrific blow. Sobered, I tore off my helmet and saw with horror two large holes in it. The NCO, Moorman, who sprang to my help, comforted me by the assurance that nothing was to be seen on the back of my head but a scratch. The shot of a far distant rifle had pierced my helmet and grazed the skull. I was half dazed and was forced to give way. With my head bound up, I made my way out of the thick of the fight. I had scarcely passed the next traverse when a man ran up behind me and gasped out that Teva had been killed by a shot in the head at the very same spot. This news finished me. I could scarcely realize that a friend with whom for years I had shared joy and sorrow and danger, and who had sung out a jest to me a few minutes before, had met his end from a senseless piece of lead. Unhappily, it was too true. All the leading NCOs and a third of the company had fallen, too, in this murderous piece of trench. Lieutenant Hopf, also, an elderly man and a teacher by profession, a German Idealschulmeister, in the best sense of the word. My two Feinrichs and many more were wounded. In spite of this, the 7th Company held the trench they had gloriously won, and remained there under the command of Lieutenant Hoppenrott, the only officer left, until the relief of the battalion. Even modern battle has its great moments. One hears it said very often and very mistakenly that the infantry battle has degenerated to an uninteresting butchery. On the contrary, today, more than ever, it is the individual that counts. Everyone knows that, who has seen them in their own realm, these princes of the trenches, with their hard, set faces, brave to madness, tough and agile to leap forward or back, with keen, bloodthirsty nerves, whom no dispatch ever mentions. Trench warfare is the bloodiest, wildest, and most brutal of all warfare. Yet it too has had its men, men whom the call of the hour has raised up, unknown, foolhardy fighters. Of all the nerve-wracking moments of war, none is so formidable as the meeting of two storm troop leaders between the narrow walls of the trench. There is no retreat and no mercy then. Blood sounds in the shrill cry that is wrung like a nightmare from the breast. On my way back, I stopped beside Captain von Brixen, who, with a few of the men, was engaged in a duel with a row of heads sticking up out of a trench running parallel, and not far away. I stood between him and another and marked where the bullets struck. Of a sudden I was again flung down into the trench by a blow on the forehead, and my eyes were blinded with blood. The man beside me fell at the same moment and began to cry out. He was shot in the temple through his helmet. Captain von Brixen was afraid he had lost a second company commander in one day. However, there was nothing to be found, on a closer inspection, except two flesh wounds on the edge of my hair, caused, presumably, by the bursting bullet or by a splinter from the wounded man's helmet. The fresh loss of blood weakened me, so I agreed to return with Captain von Brixen to his headquarters. We passed the edge of Meuvre village at the double, on account of the heavy shelling, and arrived safely at the dugout in the bed of the canal. There I was dressed and injected against tetanus. In the afternoon I got on to a lorry and went to L'Écluse, and there dined with Colonel von Oppen, who received my report with enthusiasm. After I had emptied my bottle of wine, in excellent spirits though half asleep, I took my leave. My trusty Vinker, whose face beamed with joy, had a bed ready for me, and I flung myself into it with a holiday feeling after this tremendous day. On the next day but one, the battalion was taken out and came to L'Écluse. On the 4th of December, the divisional commander, Major General von Busser, addressed the battalions concerned, and mentioned with particular emphasis the services performed by the 7th Company. I had reason to be proud of my men. A bare 80 of them had taken a long stretch of trench, besides a large quantity of machine guns, mortars, and war material, and 200 prisoners. Unhappily, we too had a casualty list of 50%, in which was a large proportion of officers and NCOs. I had the pleasure of announcing a large number of promotions and decorations. Lieutenant Hoppenrath, the leader of the storm troops, Fainrich Neupert, the stormer of the pillbox, and also the courageous defender of the block, Kempenhaus, were given the Iron Cross of the First Class for their distinguished conduct in the field. As a plaster for my fifth wound, I was given 14 days Christmas leave, and in the course of it the Knight's Cross of the House of Hohenzollern with swords was sent to me at home. The war ended by giving me peculiar views as to orders and decorations, and yet I confess I was proud to pin the enamel cross with the gold rim to my breast. This cross, my perforated helmet, and a silver cup inscribed "To the Victor of Meuvres," presented to me by the three other company commanders of the battalion, are my souvenirs of the Battle of Cambrai. The Kojul River. After a few days on rest, we relieved the 10th Company on the front line on the 9th of December. Our part of the line was in front of Bizon-en-Thoie, as I mentioned above. My company front was bounded on the right flank by the Arras-Cambrai Road, on the left by the marshy bed of the Kojul River, across which we kept touch with the neighboring company by nightly patrols. The enemy's lines were hidden from sight by a hill lying between the front lines. Apart from an occasional patrol messing about with our wire at night and the hum of an electric light engine set up in Hubert's farm not far off, we had no knowledge of the enemy. On the other hand, the frequent gas attacks were unpleasant and claimed many victims. They were carried out by means of hundreds of iron cylinders buried in the earth, and discharged by electricity in a salvo of flame. As soon as the light showed, gas alarm was given, and anyone who had not his mask on and the flap well tucked in found himself in a bad way. In many spots, too, the gas reached an almost absolute density, so that even the mask was useless, since there was literally no oxygen there to breathe. Consequently, there were many casualties. My dugout was in the steep wall of a gravel pit behind the line, and was shelled nearly every day. Behind, the iron girders of a destroyed sugar factory showed up in grotesque desolation. The gravel pit was an unholy spot. Among the shell holes filled with the refuse of war, the crosses of fallen trench dwellers stuck up awry. At night I could not see my hand in front of my face, and had to stand still between very lights in case I fell off the duckboards into the marsh at the edge of the Kojul. I spent the days, when I was not busied over works of construction going on in the trench, in the ice-cold dugout, reading a book or drumming my feet against the dugout framework to get some warmth into them. A bottle concealed in a niche of the chalk served the same purpose, and the remedy was sedulously applied by my orderlies and me. If the smoke of a fire, however small, had wound up into the still December sky, the place would have become utterly uninhabitable. So far the enemy took the sugar factory to be headquarters and behaved accordingly. Thus it was not till evening that we came alive. The little stove was then lighted and spread genial warmth as well as thick smoke. Soon the pots and pans of the ration party, just returned from Vis, clattered down the dugout stairs. They had been long and eagerly awaited. And then, when the eternal rotation of swedes, barley, and dried vegetables was interrupted by beans or dumplings, our joy knew no bounds. As I sat at my little table, I used to listen with delight to the racy talk of the men crouching in a cloud of tobacco smoke over the stove, on which stood a pan full of grog, diffusing a powerful odour. War and peace, battle and home, rest, place, and leave were discussed in the dry Lower Saxon way. Love, too, played a leading part. On the 17th of December I went on leave and came back on the 2nd of January. On the 19th of January we were relieved at 4 in the morning and marched through snow to Koi. Here we were to stay some while, training for the great offensive. Ludendorff's marvellously clear scheme of training, which was distributed even to company commands, foreshadowed the scope of the coming attack. We practiced skirmishing in line and open warfare, and did a lot of shooting with the rifle and machine gun. As all the villages behind the line were crammed to the attics, every little slope was in use as a range, so that the bullets whistled about the country very much as in a battle. A machine gunner of my company shot the CO of another unit off his horse while he was reviewing some troops. Fortunately, the wound was not mortal, and equally fortunately, the deed was not clearly brought home to us. Sometimes I made practice attacks with the company on complicated trench systems with live bombs, in order to turn to account the lessons of the Cambrai battle. Here, too, we had casualties. On the 24th of January, Colonel von Oppen, who was esteemed by all, left us to take over a brigade in the far southeast. The whole regiment keenly felt the loss. During the long years of the war, he had become part of the life of the troops he commanded. Besides the warm sympathy he took in the destiny of those under his command, he had a quality not very common among officers who have grown old in the monotony of peacetime soldiering— the power to adapt himself to the immense innovations brought about by the war. Such a man can effect marvels in wartime. Unfortunately, his last words, "Auf Wiedersehen in Hanover," did not come true. Our beloved colonel saw neither his country nor his proud regiment again. He fell a victim to plague, and lies in foreign soil far from his own country. On the 6th of February we were moved back to L'Écluse again, and on the 22nd we spent 4 days in the shelled area left of the Dury-Hendecourt road, and went on working parties into the front line at night. As soon as I saw this part of the line, opposite the slag heaps that used to be Bouillecourt, I was certain that a part of the great offensive, of which the Western Front was talking with bated breath, would be launched at this point. Everywhere construction was going forward with feverish haste. Dugouts sunk, roads laid down. The shell-hole area was beset with little placards standing in the open, and displaying incomprehensible figures that denoted presumably the positions of the batteries and headquarters. Our aeroplanes flew to and fro in a phalanx to prevent observation by the enemy. A novelty that interested us on this front was that every day, precisely at 12, a black ball was let down from the observation balloons and disappeared precisely at 12:10. This was done to let the troops know the exact time. Towards the end of the month we marched to our old quarters in Gouy. After further battalion and brigade rehearsals, we twice practiced a breakthrough of the whole division over prepared ground, with a whole trench system marked out. Finally, the general commanding the division addressed the officers in a way that left no doubt that the offensive was to be launched in a few days. The brazen spirit of the attack, the spirit of the Prussian infantry, swept through the massed troops assembled here in the opening spring on the soil of France to go through the ordeal of battle. If the aim the higher command had in view was not attained, it was certainly not the fault of the officers and the men. After 44 months of hard fighting, they threw themselves upon the enemy with all the enthusiasm of August 1914. No wonder it needed a world in arms to bring such a storm flood to a standstill. In the course of time, when the waves of hatred have subsided, history will recognize that we fought as no people ever fought before. It is a pleasure, too, to recall those evenings when we sat together round the table and talked, hard-headed, of the fresh frolic in front of us. The war of movement. Though our last coins went in wine, what need had we of money beyond the enemy's lines, or indeed in a better beyond? Who knows but that the world to ruin may be hurled, but if it last today, today's enough. On the last evening it needed Captain von Brixen's representation that the staff also had the right to exist, or we should have smashed glasses, bottles, and crockery against the walls. The men, too, were in good form. It was enough to hear them talk of the coming event as the Hindenburg Flat Race, in their dry Lower Saxon way, to know that they would take hold as they always did, with an absolute reliability and without a word too much. How could one be behindhand when these sons of the old oak-encircled homesteads went into battle? The gleam of many an ideal that shimmered for me over our war aims has been dashed to earth by war. One remains forever, this fidelity that cannot be shaken. On the 17th of March, towards dusk, we left the quarters we had now become very much attached to and marched to Brunemont. All the roads were crowded with columns on the march, eagerly pressing forward with countless guns and endless transport. Nevertheless, everything went precisely according to plans worked out by the general staff. Woe to any unit whose movements were not up to scheduled time. They were ruthlessly relegated to the ditch and had to wait hours before they found a gap into which they could squeeze. Once we were caught in the scrum and Captain von Brixen's charger was pierced by an iron-tipped wagon pole and killed. The Great Offensive. The battalion was quartered in the Chateau of Brunemont. We were told that we were to march up the line on the night of March the 19th through the 20th and to occupy the dugouts in the line near Cagnicourt, ready to go over the top on the morning of March the 21st. The task assigned to the regiment was to break through between the villages of Écoussamain and Noreul, which we knew from 1915-16, on the first day. I sent Lieutenant Schmidt, who, because of his amiability, was never called anything but Little Schmidt, on ahead to make sure of our quarters. The regiment marched out of Brunemont at the appointed hour. Their morale was excellent, in spite of pouring rain. I overlooked a drunken fellow who reeled, bawling between the files of my company, for now any harsh words could only do harm. Training was over, and now we came to business. Not a wheel of the machine was to be checked. From some crossroads where guides awaited us, the companies went forward independently. When we got as far as the second line, where we were to be quartered, it came out that the guides had lost their way. Now began a chase to and fro over the dim and sodden shell-hole area, and a questioning of innumerable troops, who knew as little where they were as we did. To prevent the complete exhaustion of the men, I called a halt and sent out the guides in all directions. Sections piled arms and crowded into a gigantic crater, while I and Lieutenant Sprenger sat on the edge of a smaller one. There had been single shells falling about 100 meters in front of us for some while. Then there was one nearer. The splinters struck the sides of the shell hole. One of the men cried out and said he was hit in the foot. I shouted to the men to scatter among the surrounding shell holes, and meanwhile I examined the man's boot to see if there was a hole. Then the whistle of another shell high in the air. Everybody had that clutching feeling. "It's coming over!" There was a terrific, stupefying crash. The shell had burst in the midst of us. I picked myself up, half unconscious. The machine-gun ammunition in the large shell hole, set alight by the explosion, was burning with an intense pink glow. It illumined the rising fumes of the shell burst, in which there writhed a heap of black bodies and the shadowy forms of the survivors, who were rushing from the scene in all directions. At the same time rose a multitudinous tumult of pain and cries